Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's November 8th, 2013. You're listening to the best poker cast there ever was. I'm Chris Cosenza.
There ever was?
Yeah, and never will be.
I'm Scott Long, by the way.
For those who are listening for the first time, that is Scott Long on the other end. So we have a new world champion, Scott.
We do.
We don't have to do spoiler alerts anymore, right? Because that's, you know, it's not like...
The only person we ever spoiled it for was you.
Was me,
so,
okay.
The fact that you know, then everybody else in the world already knows.
So. All right, very good. Well, Ryan Reese of Michigan got heads up with Jay Farber and dominated him. And captured the title in more than $8 million. I watched the whole thing.
Pretty much.
I mean, when they were playing nine-handed, I stayed tuned as much as I could, but I was really just, come on, JC Tran, you know, it'd be the biggest story ever to have a real pro win this thing again. And
yeah. And
when he was just getting bad cards or whatever it was that happened to him, I started to be like, all right, I'm fading interest real fast here. And then by the time it got to, you know, four or five handed, I was just like, all right, it's getting late. I'm going to go to sleep and see what happens. And then I woke up and it was heads up. So I watched the heads up thing all together the next day, the whole thing. And, you know, the usual comments about the Elite Nine or November Nine or whatever you want to call it. You know, it's exciting for about 30 seconds out of every hour. You know, and it's very difficult for me to watch now, you know, and I'm not the common denominator looking for the all-in hands.
Right.
You know, we talked about this last week. It's just really frustrating to not know the cards, and it's very frustrating to watch, you know, fold all the way around, button raise, and they take it. And then waiting for that 1 minute when two playable hands will clump against each other, and you can see how they play, but you don't know the cards, so... And then you're not going to go recreate the hand in your mind because they're on to the next hand once they tell you the cards. So
good point.
That got frustrating for me. But there were a couple of things that I want to talk about. It's weird. When Joe Namath does it, the world is, you know, intrigued. But when
Ryan kiss Susie Colberg in.
No. But when Ryan Reese does it, it kind of rubbed me the wrong way a little bit. You know, they interviewed him before the November 9, and he said, I'm the best player at this table, and I'm going to win the whole thing. And damn if he wasn't right. But it just rubbed me the wrong way. And I know you didn't know about this probably because you weren't really probably watching it or seeing it. But
I did watch a little bit, which I'll talk about.
Well, that's good. But it's kind of rubbed me the wrong way. You know, it was different when Joe did it. You know, he's trying to make his league be equal to the other league. You know, when he was predicting his Jets would win the Super Bowl over the heavily favored Colts and... That was kind of like, you know, he was brash, and they called him Broadway Joe and everything. But then all of a sudden, with this one, it was just like, really, Ryan Reese? I mean, you got JC Tran at this table, who's the chip leader, and it was touted as one of the most talented final tables of all time. And, I mean, I can understand that, you know, but it just rubbed me the wrong way for some reason this time. Normally, I don't really give that kind of stuff a second thought, but it just kind of rubbed me the wrong way.
Well, maybe he's just trying to raise the profile of his league to catch up to the Ante Up Poker Tour. So let me ask you this, because I watched a little bit, which I'll talk about, but not a ton. And from what I watched, which had no audio on, which I'll get to eventually,
mm-hmm.
Ryan seemed like a nice guy. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if the brashness that you're talking about, is it more him or is it more just this, yet again, we have another winner that's younger than 25 that doesn't have a lot of true life experience yet?
It could be that. It could be the first time, not the first time, but generally the first time, a mic and a camera has been shoved in his face and we get to see... You know how he reacts to that. I really don't know. He did seem like a nice guy, and he when he talked, he you know he was talking about hugging his dad and all that stuff. So, I mean, you know, it was just one of those moments, one of those comments that were, you know, a 25-year-old or a 23-year-old in this case, whatever, really probably didn't have any time to think about and just said it, and not knowing if that part of the interview would make the TV or whatever, but it did. And I'm probably making a bigger deal than it.
Well, yeah. I mean, the other thing is it's poker. So, yeah. I mean, I totally agree with what you're saying, but I can also see people listening to us going, dude, it's poker.
Yeah, I know.
Everybody should have that kind of confidence when they're playing.
Yeah, yeah. And it's one thing, you know, and that's the thing, too, is one thing to say it's confidence, another thing that it's insulting the other players.
Sure.
So they all got there just as he did, and most of them got there with the same amount of chips or clear to it. And, you know, it just, I don't know. But anyway, I'm happy for him. I thought it was an interesting heads-up match. I felt very bad for Farber, who really was card dead. And when he tried to make things happen, the one or two times when he tried to actually 4-bet or 5-bet, Ryan would have a hand. It just seemed like, and you can see the frustration on the kid's face. When he was, for a while, you know, he was chip leader when it got heads-up. He had like 100 and something, 105 or something like that to like 90 or whatever it was. And then they swap positions a couple of times, and then there was one hand where Farber really thought he had the best hand, and Ryan actually did, and that knocked him down to like 70 million. And then at that point, that's when it all fell apart for him. And he got down to like 14 million and got it all in on a draw when Reese had the best hand. He had top pair. And he sucked out for a straight on the turn. He was open-ended. And I thought to myself, even before then, I thought, he needs to keep doing this. And this is a rule that a lot of people embrace when they're facing an opponent heads up that is playing better, is a better player than they are. They should play bigger pots and take away the skill of the other player by either shoving or making really big bets. And yeah, it may blow up in your face and you may lose, but you're going to lose anyway because he's a better player than you. So why not take that tactic? And he didn't do that. Farber, the one time he did it, it worked out. He doubled through him and got right back into it. It was up to 70 million again. So, eventually. So, I was curious why he had all these coaches. He had a lot of the, you know, Ben Lamb and a lot of the guys that had come before him at November 9s and just some really good players helping him and talking to him and stuff. And even when he sucked out for that straight to get back into the match and really take control and get some momentum again, he seemed resigned, and it was really, really frustrating to watch. I felt really bad for him. I mean, even Doyle Brunson was tweeting and saying, yeah, I feel bad for this kid. Ryan Reese wakes up with a hand every hand, and Farber's card dead. And it was true. Yeah. It was so obvious. But even after he made the straight, he had the camera on him and all of his friends, his little entourage were around him. And when he made the straight, he still had a look on his face like, oh, now I got to go sit down again and play. And it was just like, wow. And I'm not saying that's what he thought, but that's what he looked like. And if anybody watches it, they'll see exactly what I mean. I felt really bad for him. And I would have played big pot poker with Reese at that point because there was nothing he could have done. He got all the way up to 70,000, and then Reese just picked him apart like he had done all night. So at that point, you got to say to yourself, look, I'm being outplayed or he's getting better cards than me. Why aren't I just getting it in when I have ace-9? You know, and then if he doesn't call, then I'm picking up the blinds. It's a lot of money at that point, you know, and I was just curious why he didn't do that.
I didn't watch that part of it, so I don't know whether there's any discussion of how much heads-up play he's had, because if I understand correctly, he was in one of the amateurs at the table, right?
True, and he has, like, two caches his whole life, and they were both, like, $1,000 caches at the Venetian. So that's a good point, too, and that's the other reason why I thought if he hasn't played a lot of heads-up, he should be shoving.
Yeah, so I guess my point is you're correct on that, but I think that's tough to pull the trigger on when you've never been in that situation. I think at that point you end up – I think back to the first time that I played heads up, and imagine everybody's this way. I think we all played it a little passively or admittedly too passively.
Yeah.
Because you're still playing it like it's a full ring game, and it's not. It's a completely different style of poker at that point. But you're not – in there with as many hands as you should be. You're certainly not raising with as many hands as you are, and you're not always, you know, playing the board, I guess I'm saying. And not so much the board there, but, you know, try to outbet them rather than outplay them.
Yeah.
That's just a whole different way of playing that you don't have the experience of it. I can see you kind of just turtling, I guess.
He was real aggressive, though. It didn't matter. Reese would either outplay him or would get better cards than him and didn't have to outplay him, just let the cards play for him. And so that's what was frustrating him was, I think his heads-up play was admirable, but when it wasn't working, that's when I thought, okay, whether you're an amateur or not, somebody in your entourage should have said to you, hey, look, it's not working. Let's try something else. You know, I'm sure he had his coach in there or his friends in there that knew how to play and should have said to him, I know you're card dead, right? You're card dead. And he's like, yeah, I'm card dead. I'm not making a hand. Because he said that a few times. You hear his mic. I was like, all right, then just get it in. You know what I mean? Just get it in and try to let something else win for you rather than, you know, outplaying this guy or trying to be a better poker player. You know, we're playing for $8 million here. I mean, he's guaranteed $5 million or whatever. So, you know, I mean, to me, it was so frustrating to watch. So I can only imagine what it was like to be him.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of pressure. For both of them, when I think about it, I mean, the great thing for us poker fans now with the November 9s, how they've broken up now where we can see it. The downside is if you're one of those combatants, you know there's going to be everybody out there with a stupid little podcast picking you apart on Twitter and all that, you know. So I think a lot of the skill in that at that point is just being able to play your game and not worry about what everybody else is saying. But I got to think in the moment that's really difficult. You know, I'm trying to put myself in that spot right now. And I think I would play the best I could and make the adjustments I would need to. But it's tough knowing that, you know, millions of people are watching you semi-live on TV.
Yeah.
And just picking apart everything you do, whether you do it right or wrong. Because, you know, there's probably 50% of the people that are saying that you played it the right way, and 50% are saying you should have been more aggressive.
I felt bad for him is what it was. I mean, I'm not picking him apart, making fun of him. He's a better poker player than I'll ever imagine I could be, but I just felt bad for him, and I thought somebody should have pulled him aside, especially during that break, because he doubled up right before the 15-minute break and got set, and he got like to 30 million at that point. So then he came back and worked it up to 70 million, and it was like, here you go, one more, you know, big pot, and he's the chip leader, and then you never know. Literally two hands from now, he could be the champion. So.
Yeah.
You know, but he just kept doing the same stuff, and Reese just kept outplaying him or getting bigger cards and better cards, and it was just, I felt bad. But I'm happy for Reese, and, you know, at least Detroit has something going for itself now. I don't know. It was very exciting to watch, you know, just the whole grandeur of it all. And that bracelet, $500,000, that bracelet.
Yeah.
That's just crazy. But it was good. I'm glad it's over, and we can start working on the next one.
Well, it's interesting that you start off the show by saying it was boring to you. I only watched about 3.5 hours of it, the very first 3.5 hours, because it happened to be on at the sports bar that my wife and I were at for the Packers-Bears game. And if any of the Packers fans watched that game, which I'm sure they all did, you could see why watching the World Series was far more exciting than watching the Packers game on Monday night. But they had it on, and they didn't have the audio, and they didn't have any of the closed captioning, so that made it a little bit different. But, I kept seeing my eye stray over there to watch it, and I realized I just haven't watched a lot of, again, quasi-live. I know it was on delay, but live poker. And it still has some excitement. Now, I mean, I watched 3 hours in between, you know, watching a football game, so it wasn't like I sat and just watched it and did nothing else, and then of course watched it for however many hours it was on. So at some point I would have gone just, you know, blind bored with it, I'm sure. But it was fascinating to me in those first couple hours how many pair over pairs there were with all-ins, and there were a couple suck-outs on that too. And then a guy that kind of sucked out, but he got sucked out on before then. It had a little excitement to me. I mean, you could hear me at the bar going, "Oh my gosh!" And it was like, "It's commercial." I'm like, "No, I know the game's not commercial. I'm watching the poker now." And I kind of got back into it a little bit. I mean, I had enough to pop some popcorn and watch the heads up match the next night. But a little bit from time to time is fun to watch for me.
Yeah, and I think my comments are even more reserved for the heads up portion of it. When it was a full table, there was a lot more play than I let on. But the heads up part was really just, I just wanted to turn the channel off. But I knew at any moment someone could win, someone would lose, and I needed to see that. So I really didn't. And I It was just so frustrating to sit there and not know the cards and to know why this kid's playing this way. And then by the time you see his cards, they're on to the next hand because it's heads up, and you're like, well, what happened on that last hand? You know, I can't really forget it. New hand, you know, and it just was really frustrating to me. And I think that ESPN is not going to do anything about it, nor is Harrah's or Caesars, because really they're still getting the viewers that they want. And at that point, they're determining the world champion. So,
right.
You know, who cares if you're bored by a couple of hands? They're trying to show you every minute of the world championship that they can. And when an average Joe plays against a pro and see if you could take him down story. So, you know, I mean, I'm not expecting them to do anything. It's just, for me, it's just not as entertaining as it used to be. So I just feel bad about that part.
Well, I'll tell you, they probably may do a fewer human interest stories coming up next year. I don't know if you saw all this, so apparently this player, Jonathan Jaffe, I guess his name is.
Yeah.
like Poker Players just was having some fun with ESPN and told me he was a dolphin trainer. And they did the whole backstory on him with a photo that was Photoshopped with his head on it. And he couldn't believe how far he got with it. And, of course, ESPN obviously very embarrassed by it. But, you know, Lana Karen is like, you know, hey, we don't have the fact checkers to fact check everything. Though I'm kind of thinking back in my mind, it's ESPN. I think you might be able to check whether the guy's trained dolphins. It's not like, you know, you said he made $12 in poker last year versus $15, you know. Seems like something you could a quick call, and maybe that's what's going to happen next year. But what a fascinating prank! I mean, half of me hates the guy for doing it, and half of me loves the guy for doing it.
Yeah, I don't know which camp I'm in yet. I'm still kind of mulling it over. I just don't understand why. You were going to get the exposure. You were going to get the attention anyway. Why make up a story to embarrass them and embarrass yourself down the road?
Yeah, that's a good point.
I can't figure that part out. I mean, you know, say Jaffe goes deep next year. Yeah. Good luck getting on TV. Good luck getting the sponsors.
Can you imagine the story? You'd have to really make up a story next year.
Yeah, exactly.
You're going to have 7 notarized documents to prove that you're actually accurate.
Really. I'm a mosquito trainer. Honest. I really am. I let them come on my arm and bite me whenever it gets cool out. You know, no, I mean, so I just don't understand his reasoning. But, you know, he had fun with it. ESPN didn't catch it in time, but he didn't go deep enough that it would matter. Because imagine if he made the November 9, didn't say anything, they'd be talking about it all the time. They'd be saying, he's with Dolphins, you know, and all that crap.
I guess I wonder at this point whether at the November 9, whether the story would have came out at that point. You know, I didn't really follow the local press of the November 9 this year like I have in the past, but I got to think at some point, some local reporter near, you know, Jolly SeaWorld or whatever this guy was supposed to be trained in the Dolphin Quest would have said, want to flesh out their story. I want to talk to his boss or somebody there and go to a photo shoot or something and find out that it's all a joke. And obviously that makes that story 20 times better and probably 40 times worse for poker players, right?
Yeah. I mean, it puts them in a bad light, but it also, I mean, you have to give ESPN a lot of credit toward the popularity of poker. We're not saying it's everything. We know the whole cams, we know internet poker, we know Chris Moneymaker, we know WPT and all that. But really, like you said, I think it was last week, you know, ESPN has been the real forefront of poker. You know, the WPT stuff on FSN and all that is still around, but it's not nearly the dynamic of ESPN poker. And so here you are, here are these guys that have, you know, brought the game to light and brought 6,000 players to this event. And you know, you're just stepping all over it. So I'm not really sure how I feel about it. I mean, I think it's kind of funny. He's a young kid, whatever, and had a joke, you know, a laugh at someone else's expense. But really, I think it does more harm than good.
Yep.
I'm not trying to be a, you know, party pooper or anything. I'm just saying it just was weird. I mean, at what point do you say to yourself, this is something I have to do today. This is fantastic. This is going to be hilarious. I'm going to make Lon McCarron and ESPN look stupid. You know, okay, well, how you feel now? You know, and if you had made the number 9 and they got embarrassed, you know, you would never, ever be on TV again. You know, not that you want to be, not that poker players need to be on TV or anything. It just felt bad.
No, and he's definitely not going to be in Dolphin Quarterly anymore.
That's right.
Big opportunity missed.
Well, to wrap up our World Series discussion today, right before the main event started, or maybe just after, I can't really recall. It was a little while ago. But one of our followers on Twitter tweeted to us about the buy-in of the main event, you know, the $10,000 price tag it has, and was saying that they felt that the buy-in should be a lot more now. That, you know, it was $10,000 in the 70s, it was $10,000 in the 80s, $10,000 in the 90s, $10,000 in 2000. It needs to, you know, show for inflation, show for cost of living, and be boosted up a little bit. And I don't know if the actual, if he gave an actual number what he thought it should be, but wondered why it hasn't gone up. And, you know, basically said, you know, if people are going to play for the world championship, they need to pay for that right or something. It was essentially that kind of a, and it was a casual kind of post. It wasn't really, but it was to us, it was to BJ Nemeth. And BJ and I got in there a little bit with this poster and talked a little bit about it, and we both agreed that the $10,000 amount to me is still is very significant. Just because that's what they started at in the '70s doesn't mean that the cost of poker should be going up. It still needs to be something that everyone can attain. And to me, I don't know about you, but I certainly don't have $10,000 burned a hole in my pocket like it's nothing, like it's chump change. It's still for the average player very difficult to achieve.
No, I burn my money in the trash can outside, like
so
dangerous in your pocket with inflammable.
The other thing too is with the popularity comes the sort of assumed inflation there, because don't forget in 1970 when this thing all kicked off or whatever, they were playing for $100,000 because 10 of them bought in for $110,000. Right. Now you're playing for $8 million on top, and $5 million for second, and $3 million for third. And so, yeah, the cost may be the same to get in, but you're earning the amount of money as if you had upped it to $100,000 buy-in and played with 30 people or whatever it is, you know. So I think that there is no reason to adjust it. And BJ was in this sort of frame of mind too. He was the one talking about the inflation and how the amount of players that are actually playing in this event now make up for the fact that you're not playing for more money, but that I think it's still the right amount. Do you think that we should be playing for more money?
Well, I think what's interesting about this, and I hadn't really thought about this until you started this conversation, but you know, every story about the World Series likes to talk about this trajectory of participation, right?
Right.
It started with 10 in the first one, and peaked at what, 8,000 or something, before now it's settling in 6,300 every year. And oh my gosh, look at the growth of poker. And yeah, a lot of it has to do with the fact that over 40 years, you're right, $10,000 was a massive amount of money back then. $10,000 now, while it's a massive amount of money for you and I, and I totally agree with that part of it, is really kind of chump change for a lot of people, particularly with satellites and things like that. So from a poker health standpoint, I think it's great that they keep it at 10K and still and keep pounding away trying to get those big numbers. And think about next year. You know, you have the WSOP.com is online in Nevada now, and you're going to have a couple other sites online there. You're going to have them online in New Jersey, Delaware, and who knows where else. So next year's field is definitely going to be bigger than 6,300, and you could probably get back up to that $10 or $12 million top prize, which is, you know, a head turner. And then the flip side, I do get the argument that, you know, are you really the, and I think some of us have given up on this anyhow, ways back and made our peace with it. You're not the best poker player in the world anymore when you win this event. Right. You're a poker player probably with a good deal of skill that was able to dance with the raindrops over 2 weeks and then come back and, you know, win a sit and go. So if you're one of those type of people that thinks that this should be the tournament that crowns the best poker player in the world, I think that's a wrong way of looking at it now. Mm-hmm. I think it's a unique event, that has a lot of buzz, and we certainly love, making a champion, a world champion out of it. But, I don't think that's the point of it anymore. I think the point of it now is just to put on poker's biggest show of the year. And you don't do that with a $100,000 buy-in. But they're, you know, but the World Series is doing other things. I mean, the $1 million back next year, that got a lot of excitement last year. But you can't tell me that those 40 people that entered last year are the best 40 people in the world. Poker players in the world, you had, you know, 10, 15, 20 good poker players in there, and then you had 20 people that just had more money than God.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't matter. I mean, you're going to have an argument either way. You know, you make that buy-in bigger, then you got an argument that you're pricing out the little guys, and if you make it smaller, then you get the argument that there's just too many people and it's not a good judge. So I think it's a good discussion to have and it's fun, but again, I don't think it's one of those that has a solution or a right answer ever.
And at this point, it's more tradition than anything too. I mean,
that's a good point. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the cool thing. It's, hey, you know what? 10 grand, you can play for a world title, and now you got to beat 6,000 people to do it. Next year, probably 8,000. And, I think it's the right amount.
What I love about that argument too, is that it's a goal.
Yeah.
You know, for poker players. I mean, everybody wants to play the main event. Everybody wants to do well. You know, back when we started the show in 2005, $10,000 was a lot more money to me than it is now. Not that, you know, we're rich or anything now, but, you know, I'm playing bigger tournaments, nowhere near $10,000, but it gets more attainable every year for me, I guess.
Yeah.
And I think as a poker player, it's not only just you're playing and trying to get to that point, but, you know, financially, you know, presumably every year you're doing a little bit better for you and your family than you were the year before, and that 10K becomes a smaller amount every year. And so at some point, it's going to get to the point where a lot of players say, you know what, I'm ready to take that plunge now, even if it's just the I'm ready to do $1,000 sit and go to get in it. That becomes attainable. So I think it's a goal. That's kind of cool to know that, you know, 20 years from now, it's still going to be 10K.
Yep.
And at that point, it's going to be something that I can afford and take a shot at that point. And it's never going to be this thing that's completely out of the realm for me.
It's funny, we talked about this today, too, because a friend of mine called me yesterday, and his buddy won a main event seat this weekend in a charity tournament in Massachusetts.
Oh, wow.
And I thought to myself, the first thing I said to him was, is he going to sell it or is he going to play? And he said he's going to play, and I thought to myself, well, that's probably the determination of when the 10,000 won't mean anything. When people automatically say, oh, I'm going to play, because who cares about getting 10 grand of cash in my pocket? That's when you'll be like, all right, it's not enough money. Let's make it 25 or 50 grand. Because right now, you know, for him to say he's going to play, and I'm pretty sure he is going to play, that was surprising to me. You know, I thought, wow, you know, you're of average means, you're not a poker player, you're just a casual player who plays home games and stuff like that, and you're going to go take that 10 grand and follow your dream. That's really cool. And
yeah,
it wasn't an easy decision for him. But, you know, when it becomes an easy decision, when they say, oh, yeah, I'm playing because who needs 10 grand, you know, that's when it's going to be like, all right, maybe we need to up it up a little bit because we're all making 100 grand a week paycheck, you know, which is never going to happen. But at this point, I think the 10 grand, like you said, it's tradition, and it's still an amount, a goal that you need to aspire to, you know. And, you know, like you said, I can't imagine us plunking down 10 grand like just in the sit and go or any other tournament. Okay. So to me, it's still the right amount, and I'm glad the conversation happened.
One last quick thing about this that I think brings it back down to more our listeners' level and our level. We have an ad coming up in this next issue of Andy Up for the North Dakota State Championship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's like $150 buy-in, something very minimal. And they get upwards of pretty close to 2,000 players for that. So if you're going to ask, I think that's the question to ask a poker player. Would you rather win a $150 buy-in tournament and beat 2,000 people? Or would you rather win a $10,000 tournament that has 100 people in it?
Right.
You know, which is the bigger accomplishment? And I got to think a lot of people are going to say, that's a great story to be able to tell people, I beat 2,000 people in a poker tournament.
Yeah, and a live one, I bet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's another argument for keeping a 10K and making those fields really big and really making it impressive.
Yeah. All right, our listener spot week. Spotlight. Each week,
spot week.
Spot week. But we spotlight a listener who called our hotline at 813-448-1120 or emailed us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com. And if they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we do with Call the Floor and Hand of the Week, we'll send them something fantastic. This week's sponsor is J-Design Playing Cards, the official playing cards of Anti-Up. Check out J-Design's great cards and more at classicplayingcards.com. This comes from A. Lee, who's an Anti-Up fan somewhere on the East Coast. I love that.
We're going to put GPS tracking into our emails, so don't think we can't find you, A. Lee.
He says, we have some ethical questions here. So, the player on his right in the tournament is flashing his cards when he peeks at them. Almost every hand, I can see one or two cards. Question number one, is it ethical for me to look? Well, here's the deal. Yes and no. when he shows you the cards, then we're going to get right to question two, right?
Yeah.
Which says, should I tell him? So the first time you see him, you say, whoa, 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 player on my right. You're flashing your cards to me. I can see him. Oh, thank you very much, sir. Okay, I'm letting you know. I've given you your warning. So when you say, is it unethical for you to look? Yeah, it's unethical for you to kind of like put your head down below his elbow and try to look underneath and see his cards. Yeah, that's not ethical. But if this guy is not protecting his hand and he keeps showing you and you're seeing him... Not, and I guess what I'm asking too is, what kind of look are you sitting there trying to see them? That's one thing. But if during the casual movement of your head, when you're watching the play come around the table or whatever it is, or when you're doing your action, then looking over to see what he's going to do, and he shows you his cards, you've already warned him. So I don't think it's unethical that your eyes are going to look at his hands to see how he's performing, whether he's going to bet, how he's betting, how he's looking at his cards, how he, you know, whatever, how he protects his cards. There are things that you're looking for. It's incomplete information. So if you've already told him once that you can see his cards and you've given him the warning and he's still showing them, then I don't think it's unethical. I mean, are we all supposed to now just look away because this player can't protect himself? You know, and then we're supposed to not look at him at all and not see his tells or not study his betting patterns? I mean, so you've given him his chance. That's what I say.
Yeah, I think that's what it comes down to, is if we're talking line of sight, then you know, it's a hindrance to your game to take your eyes away from the table, specifically to avoid this guy that can't protect his cards.
Right.
If we're talking that your line of sight is not, it's not affecting your line of sight, but it's the, you gotta sneak a look at the hot chick on the other side of the restaurant kind of thing when you're at dinner with your wife, then that's a different story, I think, to me, where you're purposely trying to look because you know it's exposed. You know, if it's impeding your ability to play the game properly, then at that point, you know, your eyes are going where your eyes should go and the cards are there to see, then that's his problem. But I think it gets more into questions three and four, which are coming up here.
Yeah, so he said, you know, that, you know, he told him, and, you know, the guy said, you know, oh, thank you, I'm so sorry, blah, 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 but then 5 minutes later, he's still doing it. So he wants to know, question number three is the same as number one, is it unethical from the look again? And I say it's not. I say that you've warned him, you've told him, and it's through your natural playing ability that you're seeing these cards because you're looking over at his chips, you're looking at him, whatever, and if he's flashing the cards to you, you've already warned him. You've already said, hey, now it's up to you now to protect yourself. So question number four was, should I tell him again? And that's up to you. If you want to tell him again, go ahead. If you don't because you feel like you did what you're supposed to do and now this guy's giving you information, then take it. Me, I would probably tell him again, especially if I'm wearing an Anti-Up shirt. You know, I have sort of this, and so does Scott, we have this sort of responsibility to the poker community and to ourselves. And whether I don't think it's cheating or not, I don't think it doesn't matter. What matters is what other people might think. And if people were looking at the publisher of a magazine in their favorite pastime and saying, hey, why do you keep looking at his cards? You know, then, oh, the Anti-Up guy cheats, you know, and then that's the last thing we would need. So me personally, I would probably say, look, man, keep showing me your cards, and I don't want to see your cards, but I have to look over here to see what's going on with the action, so stop it. you know.
Stop it.
But if I was just Joe Poker Player and I'm playing for money and this guy is an adult, you know, hey, I did what I had to do. I can't be your nanny, too. So I'm not telling you what to do here, Ailey, but for me, I probably would say something again just because of our situation. But if I was just a regular
Joe Poker Player, then no. Point, I think, because you're totally right that, you know, you told him once, and I think probably you asked 75% of poker players. They'd say you gave him one warning after that. Game on.
Yeah.
Probably even more, to be honest. But the other flip side of it is you're in a tournament, and it's really not fair for you to have that information, whether it's being made available to you or not, or whether you've warned them or not. I mean, there are, seven other players at the table, seven or eight, depending on, that aren't getting that same information that you're getting, and it's really not fair for you to have it.
Yeah.
Is what I'd come down to.
Yeah.
Now, that gets back to what I was talking before, though. If it's also not fair for you to have to change your game and not look at players as they're looking at their the cards on the table or following the action because Goofus next to you can't protect his cards.
Right.
So what I told Ailey at that point was the second time you talk to him, you know, the first time I'm sure you're being friendly, you know, hey, you know, no big deal, but you know, you're flashing your cards. You may want to be sure you protect them a little bit. That's how I imagine 95% of people would treat it, right?
Right.
Second time, now I've got to be sharper with the guy. I got to say, hey, listen to me. You know, it's not fair for me to see your cards. It's also not fair for me to, you know, look away from the table because you can't protect your cards.
Right.
You really are going to need to protect your cards because it's unfair to everybody at the table, and it's especially unfair to me because I'm the one next to you. And really try to hammer it home to this guy that you just got to protect your hand.
One way to get around it is the second time or third time you see it, you're like, he's got the six of diamonds, seven of diamonds in his hand. I know that information. I'm not supposed to know it, so I want everybody else to know it. You know, okay, what's going to happen? Four. But really, you tell the guy, look, I'm telling you, it's not fair for me to see it. Everybody else should know what you have too. So if I see your cards, I'm going to tell everybody else at the table. That's one way to stop. He won't let anybody see his cards then. Oh, man. I don't know how that's unethical or not, but that's one way of covering your butt. You know, I'm not cheating.
I love it.
Okay, so you know what? We get to complete an O'Malley's move this week. Always my favorite thing. And let's refresh our memories with part one, then we'll be right back.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are seated at a $1, $2, no-limit hold'em cash game. The action has been fairly passive all night. Strangely enough, we've got a table full of calling stations. The under-the-gun calls, plus one calls, plus two folds, MP calls, MP1 calls, hijack folds, cutoff folds, and we're on the button with the two black aces. Nice. With so many players in the hand and $300 behind, we bump it up quite a bit. We make it $25 to go, 12 and a half times the big blind. Both blinds fold, as do the early position limpers, all the way to the MP1, who thinks for a short time before calling. This player has an identical stack to ours, and is an extremely passive calling station. He was down to life support with $20 to his name before hitting a miraculous one-outer and has been on a roll ever since. He seems to be fairly new to the game. Everyone else folds, and with $56 in the pot, we see a flop of the King of Spades, Queen of Clubs, Three of Hearts. The MP checks, and we keep up our pre-flop aggression with a $40 bet. Curiously enough, he calls. With the pot at $136, the turn is the Jack of Hearts. Once again, the MP checks. We make another stab at the pot, this time with an $80 bet. This leaves us with roughly $150 behind. Again, the MP calls. The river is the Deuce of Clubs, essentially a blank, and once again, the MP checks. What's the move here?
You know, I played way too much. $2 straight stud here in Florida. For players who witnessed the dress period in person, they know that calling stations will call you down with strong hands almost as often as they will with weaker middling hands. Long-time listeners of our show probably remember when I played the sub game and it was check at the end, and I bet all calls and everybody's got full house. I'm like, well, what? What are you doing? So that is burnished in my mind, that particular hand years ago, and it affects how I'm looking at it this way. So what I learned from that is the way you beat these kind of players is to punish them when you have the goods. In this hand, if you're asking me, yeah, I think we do have the winner here, but it's far from quote-unquote the goods. And I'm just going to check behind. I'm going to be happy with the pot as is or happy with not being pelted. Either way, happy.
I'm with you. Check just in case. For me, this pot is huge for a passive 1-2 game. So, I mean, it's not like you didn't get value already out of this if you win. And if you're beat, you're going to get called, so a check could save you money. I'm happy, just like you, happy with the pot size right now. I'm dying to hear part two.
Hello again. This, to me, is a pretty clear-cut scenario. If we bet, we risk losing to a raise or a call from a better hand. This might be a value betting situation with a calling station, but a proper bet would be for most of the rest of our stack, and at that point, we may as well just put it all in. However, we don't want to go bust with only a single pair. We check behind. Our opponent confidently tables the Queen of Diamonds, Jack of Diamonds, for two pair, and we're left scratching our heads in utter amazement at his calls at every point in the hand. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying, be careful of calling stations. Before you know it, you could have blown an entire stack on one hand. I hope to see you on the field.
Well, you know, I don't get to say this too often, but I called it! you know, it's a head-scratcher always, but you do have to realize that some players do honestly play this passively. And it's like landmines. You gotta avoid them. And to be honest, if I had a choice of table, I would get away from this table just because it's tough to play against these players that are completely unpredictable at this point.
And I don't get to say this very often either. Scott was right.
Pretty sure he's never said that.
But you're so right. And these players who play this passively, they have one thing on their mind. They think that the way they're going to make money is to trap you all the time. And so they're trying to get as many people in the hand as possible, and they don't notice that they lose a lot more when they do this than they would make if they were aggressive and unpredictable. So these types of players, that's what they live for. They live for making a big hand, keeping you in, and getting as much money out of you as possible for that one time they could be like, see, my strategy works.
Well, you know, it's almost even too complicated of a discussion about this player. I think some of these players, honestly, they're just out there to bide the time.
Yeah.
It's social. You know, hey, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to play poker. And, you know, I hate to bring up the bingo reference because I don't really mean it that way, but it's like their cards are their bingo cards.
Yeah.
You know, they get dealt a card, somebody bets, all right, I'll call. If no one bets, all right, I'll check. And at the end, I turn my cards over and I win. Yay! and, you know, I'm not making fun of that. Just, you have to understand that that's what some people do. They're not everybody sits down at the poker table, has read 100 books and listened to 20 podcasts and watches ESPN and is there to make the proper move every single time.
Yeah.
Some people are just happy to be out of the house for a day.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm glad he checked.
All right. It's time for Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. This week's sponsor is TournamentButton.com, which offers a variety of home dealer buttons with timers built right into them. You can even customize them with your own photo or logo. Be sure to ask about the AntiUp logo version and use code AntiUp for free shipping. And this one comes from Josiah Mori.
Hmm.
One of the cooler Hand of the Week names that we've ever had.
Yeah.
He's all the way from Burbank, California, where like every game show was taped when I was growing up.
Yep, that's I always think of Johnny Carson when I hear that.
Yeah, or Bill Cullen. Welcome to Blockbuster from Burbank, California. And then you finally go out to Burbank and you're like, oh my gosh, it's like 7 square miles here. It's like tiny as anything.
Yep, yeah.
Still pretty cool though. So maybe Josiah hasn't said it, but maybe he's going to join us on our Antiup Poker Cruise out of Los Angeles.
Yes.
March 30th. Go to antiupcruises.com for all that information.
Yes.
All right. So here's what he says. He's like, I've been getting into poker recently. I've been devouring Antiup podcast.
Hmm.
probably the most active verb ever used.
Make sure you taste us with relish. We're really good that way.
I like some like lemon pepper on it.
Or like sea salt. The sea salt
brings out the flavor, yeah. He says, I'm going back to listen to many of the older episodes as well. And so he wanted a different perspective on this hand he played recently. He was at the Commerce Casino playing their $1 to $40 max No Limit Hold'em table.
Hmm.
I'm trying to think whether I even knew they did this. That's pretty wild, a $40 max buy-in.
That's weird.
Or a 1-2. So, I mean, you buy in at max, you get 20 big blinds.
Yeah.
He said, I've been getting rags most of the night. Must have been playing with Jake Barber. And, well, the only other hand I played and had to flip previously being a full house. The rest of the table is extremely loose. Presumably due to the pretty lady who sat down at the table. The villain has been loose with the rest of the table, rarely folding and getting caught off in playing paint with low kickers or strange draws. He has rebought two or three times, and we currently have an almost equal stack of about $50. And we are in the big blind. There are under the gun calls, two middle position players calls, cutoff, and the small blind call.
Jeez.
So, yeah, people from other casinos even are calling in his hand. And we are the big blind with seven of spades, deuce of clubs. And as O'Hara says, my night of being in the Death Valley of cards continues.
Shove.
really no discussion here, right? So,
yeah, just glad we check.
Happy to hit something on the flop here and take down all these numbers.
Yep.
All right, pot's $10, and our hero says, well, I was ready to fold this hand to any raise, but since there was not, to check the option. And the flop comes, king of spades, seven of clubs, king of hearts.
Eh, that's not a good flop for us. Just because we get the seven doesn't mean anything. I mean, people limp all the time with any king. People limp all the time with any 7-8, 7-6, 7-9. I don't like that flop at all. I'm checking.
I would say I don't like it at all.
Oh, well, the reason why I don't like it is because it gets me it gets me in a lot of trouble. I have no kicker, and this is the kind of, especially at a $40 buy-in tournament, table, this is the kind of, you know, guys are sitting down with any two cards. So any two cards with a seven in it beats us, and any two cards with a king in it beats us, and we can be beat by pocket eights, you know, who knows. So I would like a flop like, you know, like queen, deuce, deuce, or something. But this hand,
seven,
I'm not...
Seven.
Yeah, of course. But I'm not happy about this. I mean, it's not fantastic. Right. This isn't, I'm not going to get too invested in this, that's for sure.
Exactly.
I would check.
All right, well, our hero says, this got me a little interested. So since there was consistently a raise by any ace or paint card, I'd figure out to put out a bet representing the board, seeing that I had a tight aggressive image, and figuring I had something here with a pair and several outs to a full house, I bet $7.
I don't know.
We've already discussed the problems with this, right?
Yeah, I think I would just check and feel out what's going to happen after that. You know, I would be so willing to just let it go if somebody bet now. I would have to see the turn. And even then, what card would I want to see on the turn? Another seven? Well, now you're still losing to a king, so it didn't help you. You know, I just don't like this at all.
Yeah, I'd much rather see a king.
It's unlikely somebody has
the fourth king, and now I've got the full house, and now I can bet a big there with that one card to come for somebody else to kind of kick me.
Yeah.
All right, well, we bet the $7. We get three callers, including the small blind, which is probably the reason we don't bet there.
Yeah.
Because I was going to say this before. I've been at loose tables where everybody limps in, and then everybody folds on the flop if they don't hit. But this sounds like one where it's loose all the way to the end. So if it's the former, then yeah, maybe I put a bet in there and take it down, because if no one has anything, and if he's right, then no one, everybody always raises with a paint card.
Mm-hmm.
I'd feel a little more confident about it. But obviously that doesn't seem like the table that we're at. All right, pot's $38, and the turn is the king of clubs.
Wow.
They get the board, the king of spades, seven of clubs, king of hearts, king of clubs. I actually forgot that was coming when I said that before.
Wow. Okay, well, really, the only thing we're afraid of then is a bigger pair or a club. I mean, or a king. So the pot's like 38. I mean, I'd probably bet 20 Although if I only have 50 to start and I've already bet 7 plus the 2, that's like 10, so we're down to 40. I don't know if I'm going to bet my whole stack on that. Oh, man. This is a weird...
Yeah, see, this is, again, folks, this is why we don't like to play out of position.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you're really stuck here, you're right. You know, we were aggressive on the flop when we didn't need to be, and now we're in the situation where if we bet, you're right, we're committing ourselves for the most part, right? We have to, which is not something I want to do with this board. And if I check, then it's like we wasted that $7 on the flop. Someone's going to bet here, right?
Yeah. Maybe a check call's in order. I don't know. I mean, it feels like some of these people who called might have baby pairs and think, if you don't have the 7, then I have the best hand. And now if the king comes, they're going to think, well, if you don't have a 7, I have the boat. You know, so there could be hands in there like 2s and 3s, that kind of thing.
Right.
Or deuces. I don't want to make Scott.
You know, the other thing about the king coming now is it makes it less likely that we have it in our opponent's minds, you know?
Yeah.
Like, all right, maybe he was just trying to bet us on the king. Well, now there's 3 kings out there, and no way he's got the 4th king. So my 8s are probably good.
Yeah, that's a... Well, I don't know. If I were playing this hand, I probably would bet like $15 and see what happens. I don't know why. Doesn't seem like a particularly good bet. Maybe half the pot is right, so, you know, 17 or 18 or something. But I don't know. It's so weird because if you bet that much, you're betting half your stack already, and you can't fold to a raise, so why bet that much? You might as well either shove.
Yeah, I think we're going back to the check call. I think the check call is...
Yeah, it feels right. You know, that way, if he has kings, he might value bet on the end. You could just call, and then, okay, he's got quads. I only lost 20 of my stack here, 30 of it, rather than the whole thing for no reason. So, check call might seem in order, especially if somebody out there has got, like, 5-5, and they think they're good. You know, mm-hmm. they're basically bluffing into you. So, yeah, check call sounds right to me. Just depends. If somebody shoves, then I'm probably going to call, because they really shove with quads. You know what I mean? Why shove with quads when you could... You know you can't lose. So I would probably check call.
All right. Well, our hero says, I hit the full house. I look at who's left in, and based on the way they played the night, I couldn't put anyone left on a hand better than mine. It seemed to me that they were holding flush draws, a 7 like me and weak aces. Nor to play so far or the percentages put anyone on a king. So I bet 15 to go with my boat.
Okay, well, that was one of the numbers I had suggested. So if you're going to bet, I don't mind that number. The other thing, too, I wanted to get back to is when he said anybody with paint or an ace was raising. But he also said including the small blind before when he was talking about the mm-hmm. betting. So the detective in me is wondering, is he saying that because a small blind is someone who is the villain really in this hand? And if he's really the villain, then a small blind would easily just call with like a king deuce of hearts or, well, in this case... You know, the king deuce of diamonds. You know, because he wouldn't raise with the king deuce, but he might call with it because the suited king and a, you know, a discounted dollar to see the flop, you know. So anybody could have quads here. So to me, I wouldn't dismiss quads the way he did just a second ago because someone didn't raise. You know, there's very easily a king out there that doesn't raise in this situation, but it could still be in his hand. So. Anyway, if you're going to bet, I think 15 probably is the right amount. Maybe. I don't know. It seems like it's the right amount. And if somebody shoves on you, I don't know. I mean, it's not that much money, really. You're playing it.
Yeah, at that point, you're left. Yeah, it's...
You know.
Well, I'll take the mystery out of it right now. The small blind is not the villain because after a $15 bet, only one player in middle position calls.
Okay.
Small blind folds. So we're heads up, going to the river with a $68 pot. And as he says, I'm heads up with Mr. Loose Aggressive, and I'm fairly certain he has something like 7-ace unsuited or even 7-6. I figure we'll probably have to end up splitting this pot unless I can push him off. The river is the deuce of diamonds, making the final board. King of spades, 7 of clubs, king of hearts, king of clubs, deuce of diamonds. Total nothing card for us.
So we're only worried of a bigger pair, which likely would have raised preflop, or a random king. Mm-hmm. Which could very well be in this hand, but I don't mind checking the guy now because here's why: we don't have the nuts, and we are beat by a lot of hands. Not a lot of hands make sense that beat us, but the one that really makes sense is the suited king. and it could be a crappy king. So if we check, we can maybe get him the value bet for 10 or 15 in the end, and we still have $20 left, you know, with just a call. So a bet here, I think, is not wise. I feel like, why not just check? And if the guy bets, you're going to call anyway, but maybe he'll bet less, so you're not getting felted for no reason for quads. So don't go broke in an unraised pot if you can avoid it. So I would just check here and hope he bets like 15 and call him right away. And hey, you got $20 left in this game. All you got to do is put 20 more on the table and you're at the max anyway. So,
The interesting thing about this hand is that, the only reason that we're discounting a king being in someone's time, and I'm not saying we are completely, but is that his assertion that people have been raising with kings pre-flop all night.
Right.
The fact that no one raised it, they don't have. Otherwise, I don't think there's anything in this hand that would be out of kilter for somebody having a king.
Right.
You know, you've got a rainbow board on the flop, and you got somebody betting into you, so why not string them along, right? And then you get your quads on the turn. You really want to raise on that point at that point. Particularly if somebody's betting out, you might as well let them bet into you one more again. It's a different hand than something else. At this point, I think raising on the turn, you're shutting down the action.
Right.
So now you're just – and then you've got position, obviously, on the person betting to you. So let them bet one more time into you on the river and then obviously raise at that point because there's no reason not to. In fact, actually, it's unethical not to. And get it in at that point. So normally I would be fairly scared, not scared, but certainly a tendency up for a king the way this hand has played out.
I couldn't agree more. The other thing too that we haven't really discussed is that we're chopping this and that somebody else had 6-7
sure.
or limped. So that's a very real possibility here, but it would be a very boring, uneventful hand of the week. So I think that it could be a king and... But I do like the check, because even if we have the same hand, we're not going to fold it, and we're going to split it anyway, and the only thing we're going to lose is the rake. So I like a check call here. No matter what the bet is, I think I'm probably even calling the all-in, because I'm not going to scare anybody off. I don't think I'm going to scare a 7 off. You know, I might scare a 5 off, but that's you know the chance you have to take, I guess, by betting. But I don't think – you know, a pocket 5s, I mean, or
– Yeah, and I think the other thing, too, we haven't talked about this, but I think you got to understand the game you're in here, too.
Yeah.
A 1-2 no limit, this is a very different 1-2 no limit than most of us play. And, you know, most rooms, it's a 100 to 300 buy-in range, right?
Mm-hmm.
$40 max. This is really a limit poker game for people that would like to stay all in.
Yeah.
I mean, when the bust you have is $40 in front of you until you win and build it up, obviously. There's not a lot of poker to be played at that point. You know, you're going to be calling bets and people are going to be peeling off, you know, two Andes every couple of hands, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
And so what kind of player is going to play that game? Well, it's going to be a player that likes action but doesn't like to put themselves at too much risk, which is kind of a weird way of looking at it because if you burn through three buy-ins, you probably were better off playing a 1-2 no limit 100 to 300 and took one shot with your stack than this. So you're not going to get anybody out of these hands, I don't think. I'd be shocked that if too many of these hands didn't go to showdown.
The funny thing is, when I hear this game, it makes me think of the 50 cent dollar, $20 minimum buy-in that I used to play at the Silks before they got rid of it. Guys would buy in for 20 and then just get it all in on draws, and all you had to do is hot top pair and you're going to clean up. I mean, I like I said, I a couple of guys and me were sitting there with like 400 in front of us buying in for 50. It was just crazy because guys just didn't care, you know.
Right.
And this is the same kind of situation. These people, they don't, if they can get it all in three times in a night for $40 a pop, it's the equivalent of getting it in once with $100 a pop. So, you know, that's, it's a lot more leverage. A lot of people do that too. A lot of people buy in for 40 even when it is, you know, $100 or $300 max, but the minimum is 40. They do that a lot and they just wait for the hand with the draw to shove because it's leverage. You know, it's like, do you really want to put $40 on your top pair or your second pair when this guy, you don't know what this guy has, and then he ends up having a draw, hits it, doubles up, and walks away from the table. So this reminds me a lot of that. So let's check. What's he gonna do?
All right, so he says, no overs to beat my full house on the board, but I'm posturing like I have the king. I put out a bet of $20. After thinking for a moment, our villain raises it to 5, which is odd. I have 6 left, so I toss it all in. So I'm not really sure what's going on here, because can't really do that. Obviously, we're going to call it. And our opponent flips over the Jack of Clubs and then the King of Diamonds. Burned, he says.
Yeah, I see that.
I know you can't live in fear of the four of a kind, but I realize I was a dog the whole way, but did I misplay this? I said, I realized I wasn't pushing him off his hand once the flop hit. I'm still leaning on accurately putting people on ranges. Would there have been a better way to play this? So let me know that he had something soon as the flop came down. Because I've lost with full houses 4 times in the last week to a better board or 4 of a kind. I want to know if I need to change my approach on how I play these hands.
Well, I think we've sort of ad nauseum explained why this is probably not the hand to play. Again, there's no flop that I like with this hand that doesn't involve at least trips for me.
Right.
Or 2 pair for me. And even the 2 pair for me is going to get you into trouble because, you know, inevitably it's going to go runner, runner for a bigger 2 pair or pair his other card. So you're happy you got to see a flop, but really got to hit it hard when you're holding these 2 cards. And this is not a hard hit. This was a very mediocre hit with no kicker. And I think the whole way down we talked about, you know, betting. I wasn't sure if I wanted to bet there, but he bet. And then on the turn, I definitely wouldn't have bet because, you know, somebody else could have quads, somebody else could have a better 7. Although at that point it was a boat, but I mean, it could have the same 7 and put Ness to a test. You know what I mean? There are so many reasons to not bet this hand, and we don't have that much money anyway. So the $20 bet on the end, you only had with 30 left as it was. So it was kind of, or 6 left. So it was kind of weird to even bet 20. And I think if you checked, he might have bet less and you might have saved money too. So I think there are a lot of different ways that you could have played it. I never want to say should because,
right, yeah,
you know, it's poker and everybody could have their view of how this hand could, should be played. But to me, I would not have been excited by that flop and I would not have been excited by the turn, although Scott did say it would be less likely that somebody has the king. And the other thing too is using the generic, rules that you applied to all these players that they always raised with a king seemed odd, or paint seemed like an odd statement to me. And here was a perfect example that no, they didn't always raise with paint. And you don't know they always raise with paint because you didn't always see all their hands at showdown to know that they always raise with paint. So that's kind of a non sequitur for me. I never even would have even considered that as a reason to not think somebody had a king in their hand.
Yeah, what I wrote back to him was that when he was asking about, you know, I've lost these full houses 4 times last week. What I want to know is where is he at the table when he's losing with these? Mm-hmm. If it always seems to be in the big blind, then it's not a full house problem; it's a position problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously, no one's folding Jack. A 7 deuce when there's no raise here. But it's what you do after that, and as we talked about, it's not a flop that anybody should have got excited about. But if that's what's happening, if you're out of position playing against these things, I think that's the bigger issue than anything else. And particularly in this 40-hour max, because it's impossible to overcompensate for lack of position when everybody's got 20 big blinds in front of them.
Right, I think it's Lyle Berman's chapter in Super System 2 for the PLO. Obviously, you're going to see it a lot more in PLO than you would in Hold'em, but you really got to be careful of the underfulls,
mm-hmm,
especially when you're holding one card to make the underfull. That is just, you know, even in this case, if the guy didn't have a king, but the river comes an 8, you know, and he had ace 8 or something, you know, you always got to be wary of the underfull when you're out of position with just one card to the underfull. It'd be one thing if you had pocket threes and it came king, king, 3, and you have the underfull because someone else could have king 3 or the turn is a queen, he has king, queen. That, you know, but in this case, you have one card making your full. I just, and it's the underfull on top of it. I just would be so wary of that.
Yep.
All right. Well, that was an interesting hand. I wasn't really sure if it would be when you consider the buy-in, and usually people, I thought it was just going to be this guy shoves, but it wasn't like that. So Josiah, thanks for the hand, and hope you appreciate that tournament button from tournamentbutton.com. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the table.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.